This is Rush to Reason on KLZ 560.
And we are back. Rush to Reason, Denver's Afternoon Rush, KLZ 560. As I said a little bit earlier, our second guest joining us now, Steve Gorham joining us. Steve, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, John. Great to join you again.
I appreciate it. Author of Green Breakdown, The Coming Renewable Energy Failure. Are climate lockdowns coming, Steve?
Well, we're getting close. There are a bunch of people that would like to. Thousands of scientists are calling for a climate emergency. Want all the nations to declare a climate emergency, and if that's the case, then maybe we would have lockdowns.
Right.
But we have other things going on. The EPA, for example, is tightening emissions from vehicles and mileage from vehicles, so it's going to be impossible for automakers to produce a line of gasoline vehicles fairly soon.
Correct.
Department of Energy also is passing regulations which are going to impact gas stoves and prevent those from being produced as well. In France, they have stopped short flights. They want everybody to be on a train to help save the planet. And they just took a poll out there, and 40% of the people think that you should be restricted in your lifetime
yes.
on the number of airline flights
yes.
you can take.
I read that. Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it's just it's more and more government trying to control your life rather than releasing the free market to do what it does best and enjoy yep. a comfortable life and reward the people for what they do. We've got plenty of energy in this world to make that happen. We're squandering it as far as I'm concerned, Steve, and I know you agree with me. You know, we say, you know, green energy, but the reality is there's not one single thing that's green about it. It's an oxymoron. At the end of the day, without oil, you don't even have, you know, quote unquote green energy.
No, you can't build a wind turbine without oil.
You cannot.
You can't build solar panels. You can't build anything. It is remarkable, but climatism has become the ultimate tool for
yes.
governments to be able to enforce whatever they want on vehicles or even housing and all sorts of different things.
Yeah, and on the vehicle side, you know, being a car guy like I am, and I've watched this pretty closely, and for what Steve is talking about, for those of you maybe that don't know this, they're trying to pass some legislation right now that would literally allow every state to do what California does, Steve, and set their own guidelines emission-wise, which would be actually disastrous to the manufacturers of cars, because if you're making, you know, right now, as it you know used to be, it's not so much as bad as it used to be, although even today there's things that you can't you know put in California, they can put elsewhere. The reality is the manufacturers are going to make it more difficult for them to manufacture on the level that each state would want, the distribution of those cars. I mean, Steve, you can just imagine. It just becomes an ultimate nightmare for those guys. And frankly, I think some of them would just say, you know, do we really want to sell cars this way anymore?
Yeah, it is crazy. And there's even a darker side that most people aren't aware of. California just passed what they call an Advanced Clean Fleets Regulation that says any new truck that is registered in California or purchased in California has to be zero emissions
That's
effective
right.
January 1st of this year. And there's about 10 other states that are going to pick this up, we're afraid. And this has huge problems. For example, in a long-distance truck, you can fuel for 15 minutes on diesel fuel and go 1,200 miles. But an EV truck can only go 150 to 330 miles, and it takes hours to fuel it.
Right.
The EVs, it costs 2 to 3 times more for every truck.
Right.
So think about the impact on inflation with freight.
That's right.
They force all these people to buy these expensive trucks, and all our prices are going to go up.
Yeah, there's a direct correlation. I talk about it on our program all the time, Steve, where these companies, these trucking companies and the like, they won't absorb these costs. They get passed on to the consumer. The consumer is the one that ends up paying for everything. By the way, that's why I don't believe in corporate taxes, because you and I as consumers end up paying those corporate taxes anyways. And this is just another tax, if you would, when it's all said and done. And the other thing, Steve, that really bugs me about all of this is there's no such thing as net zero emissions. It doesn't exist. It's another
nope.
play on words. It's a lie.
It really is. I like to put up a picture of a grass hut when I present to groups, and I tell them, if you build any kind of a structure and you put glass in it and you put copper in it and you put ceramic in it, you put wood in it, you put steel in it, all of those things emit carbon dioxide when they're produced and when they're transported. You can't even build a grass hut that is zero emissions, because when you cut down the grass and cut down the wood and build a hut, you release carbon dioxide.
Great point.
I mean, it's
yeah.
frankly an impossible
it
thing.
It is. And thank you. I mean, it's one of those things that I keep
down.
Focusing on here. You'll enjoy this. It's been a couple of years ago now, but I was touring a house.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about moving, and you know, I'm just one of those guys, I'm always looking, and if the right deal comes along, of course, I'll move. I'll look at that. It's just the kind of guy that I am. So I'm looking at a house this one day. It was a new house, and I walk in, and the realtor's there, and he's got the builder there, and it's kind of a new spec home that was done. And so the builder's there, the GC is there, the owner, you know, the investment guy is there, and the realtor's there. So I walk in, and my wife and I, and the first thing that the investment guy says, well, I just want you to know that, you know, this is a net zero carbon neutral house. And I said, huh? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, you know, that doesn't exist, right? And he kind of looked at me kind of funny. And I'm like, it doesn't exist because everything I'm standing inside of took energy to produce. And I don't care if this house stood for the next 100 years. You're not going to get all of that back because every single day someone lives here, you're still using more. So there's no such thing. Stop saying that. I said, you're lying to all of your people in your advertising when you say that. This group, by the way, Steve, A, didn't really know what to think. B, ended up being pretty conservative, and they were like me when it was all said and done. Well, you know, we kind of have to put that in on the marketing side of because of where we are and blah, blah, yeah. blah. And I'm like, stop lying to people.
Yeah, it's such a shame. We're in the midst of what is the biggest superstition in modern history. The idea, yeah. A, that carbon dioxide is causing dangerous global warming, and B, that we can control it. I mean, Earth's climate is, when you think about it, water vapor is Earth's dominant greenhouse gas, not carbon dioxide. It causes five times more greenhouse effect than carbon dioxide. And the water cycle is huge. Yeah. It's all the oceans and all the ice caps and the water vapor in the air and the rivers and streams. It's got 1,000 times the energy of the carbon
That's
dioxide
right.
cycle.
That's right. And we're not even counting all of the underwater volcanoes that, by the way, have as much to do with heating up, you know, surface temperatures in the ocean as anything else that we talk about, Steve. Again, these are all things no one ever really wants to address. Really quick, because I knew you were coming on. A listener sent me this. I got a full list. I won't go through all of these, but there's a few climate emergencies. That's the name of this subject of this email that he sent me. So okay. I'm just going to give you a few of these that I'm sure you'll get a chuckle at. 1967, dire famine forecasted by 1975. 1969, everyone will disappear in a cloud of blue steam by 1989. 1970, the ice age will be here by the year 2000. 1970, America subject to water rationing by 1974 and food rationing by 1980. 1971, the new ice age is coming by 2020 or 2030. Steve, do you understand? You do. I mean, all of these are fear-mongering ideologues that just want to pump fear into the general public so they can then push whatever agenda they want to push, and that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Paul Ehrlich, the population bomb, he said, I bet even money that the United Kingdom won't be around in the year 2000. Al Gore said in 2007 said all the ice in the Arctic was going to disappear in the summer in 2014. I've got most of these things in all my books. They make great sidebars on lunacy of the world. But unfortunately, people believe this stuff.
They don't just believe it, Steve. To your point, it has become literally their religion. They don't just believe it. They worship it.
Yep, it's climatism. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned before, but two candidates are now using that term to describe the fear of man-made climate change. Mr. Trump and Mr. Ramaswamy are using the word climatism. So we all should be using it. It's a very effective thing for the ideology.
No, and by the way, appreciate the book, by the way, Green Breakdown, The Coming Renewable Energy Failure. And Steve, again, being a car guy, I just went to our big trade show that we had last week out in Las Vegas as an automotive industry, and it covers tons and tons of convention space there. They fill up even some of the other hotels nearby. It is the second largest one next to the CE, whatever it is, the home electronics, you know, the electronic show that's there, that's in January. At any rate, you know, the big buzz has been for the last several years is EV this, EV that, and, you know, EV conversions for different types of vehicles and cars and this, that, and the other. But what was interesting this year that I thought was sort of funny, maybe isn't the right word, but just observation on my part. I didn't see that. I mean, it was still a heavy focus, don't get me wrong, but you didn't see one in every booth like I did last year. So I think what's really happened is some of the folks have finally started realizing that, well, wait a minute, you know, for certain applications, this might work out very well. I'm a free market guy. If you're a guy that wants to own one and buy one, fine, let the free market drive those purchases. But I don't want the government telling me or anybody else, Steve, what to do. But I think what's happening inside of the auto industry itself is there's been a real rude awakening to, wait a minute, time out. I think the first wave of really solid buyers have already bought, and yeah, they may rebuy, but we're not really gaining traction with any new buyers outside of that core group. And I think our industry is finally realizing that.
I agree. This, the EV market has hit a big speed bump. The early adopter phase is over. U.S. EV inventories are up 300%. There's very poor demand for these EV pickup trucks. The pickup drivers aren't really interested. Ford Motor is losing between $40,000 and $60,000 each EV. They're projecting a $4.5 billion loss. Ford and GM have cut back on their forecasts, and it's even hard to get insurance in some places. In England now, to insure an EV for a year, you pay over £5,000.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of issues with them. And you know, again, I'm not against EVs.
No, me neither. I mean, I own one. I own one just to really, honestly, Steve, so I could learn about it, know about it, talk intelligently about it, where I don't think most people on either side of the aisle do. I mean, there's a lot of folks on the other side that talk about how great they are that don't own one. There's a lot of folks on our side that condemn them that don't own one. I wanted to be that guy that actually could give real-world experience as to what it's like owning one. Is it practical? Is it not? But at the end of the day, Steve, and this is one thing everybody forgets, you still have to be able to afford to buy one. So, I mean, the reality is this is still a upper income game because the average person living paycheck to paycheck is not going to buy an EV, Steve.
And it's going to stay that way because of all the metals that have to go into these things.
Right.
They require six times the metals of a gasoline car, and that means loads more global mining. And there's all kinds of social and environmental costs with that
that's
people don't see when they buy their EV.
No, I'm like you. I really feel like we've, you know, that the there's not going to be a hockey stick by any means when it comes to EV purchases. I look at it much like you just said, a speed bump where those early adopters, folks like myself even, where I just wanted to learn about it and know more about, you know, I'm a car guy. I love technology. So, you know, I want to learn about it and see how it works and is it really, you know, worth owning and how does it work and what kind of people would it be applicable to and so on. And the other thing, Steve, no doubt about it. This is one thing if you're a car guy. I mean, they are the most exhilarating thing you could ever drive because it is absolute instant power. There's nothing that you have to wait to wind up as in a typical, you know, ICE vehicle. So if you're really into driving, are they a thrill to drive? Absolutely. But am I going to go coast to coast in one? Absolutely not.
Yeah, they're great second cars, I think. As a matter of fact, University of Chicago did a survey of all of the EVs in California, and they were being driven an average of 5,500 miles a year. So they're not the main car. They're typically a second car. And hey, or if you're driving short distances, you can charge at home. They're great.
Yep.
But for a lot of the market, that's just isn't the case.
No, I mean, I'm a prime example of where it works perfectly. I drive round trip typically 65 to 70 miles a day. I have a Chevy Bolt. Even in the wintertime with the lack of battery juice and the lack of power, I should say, that you get in the wintertime versus summertime because there's a degradation of the battery there in the wintertime when it's cold. I can still average in the winter 200 miles. So, Steve, I'm still more than capable of doing what I do daily all year long. And I'm a guy that can do 10, 12,000 miles a year on that car. But I'm unique because I'm using it the way the car was designed. I fear there's a lot of folks even that have bought those that hate it because they didn't buy it for the right reasons.
Well, it's again, I'm not against EVs. Just don't tell me you're going to stop the oceans from rising if we all buy one. I mean,
It's ludicrous. Again, Steve, that's another lie that we're being fed. By the way, I've said this for years. I've been on air so long, Steve, on my Saturday show on the car side. When Priuses first came out, I challenged listeners way back then, because I had some skeptics and even some folks from the other side of the aisle. I challenged folks back then to prove to me that you could have been driving a 10-mile-to-the-gallon F-250 back in that day, and for you to go buy a Prius thinking you're going to, quote-unquote, save the planet, the amount of oil that it takes, just oil alone, to make the Prius, service it, handle it, the dealer network, everything else that goes into it, you could drive that F-250 at 10 miles to the gallon until you die and still not be equivalent to what that Prius took to build.
Yep, probably not.
I did the math on it, and nobody has ever proven me wrong on that. That challenge still stands, Steve, because it had to get built in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark Mills, an energy expert who wrote the foreword for Green Breakdown, has written an article on that. He says nobody really knows whether an EV produces more carbon dioxide than another car. It depends on a zillion factors.
Right.
and you got to drive several hundred thousand miles before it might become the low emissions vehicle.
And what's interesting about that, going back to what you know you guys write about and what you're talking about, Steve, I looked this up. I really looked hard. I spent one almost entire day doing enough research trying to figure out, okay, has there been any college, any university, anybody around that's done the research to tell me that if I buy a brand new EV, you know, mid-priced EV, has anybody done the math on the amount of oil that it took to actually, oil and other minerals, to actually build that EV? Now, there's figures out there on, you know, how much mining has to take to get lithium out and so on and so forth. But I'm talking, Steve, give me an actual barrel number. Not once it hits the factory floor, but I want to know, getting all the raw material rounded up, everything delivered just in time, so as the assembly line's rolling for that EV, everything's there. I want to know what it's taken to run the plant. I want to know the infrastructure costs, the dealer network costs, and so on. No one yet, Steve, that I know has done that.
I'd have to work on that. I do know, though, that if you put solar cells on your house, you have to be south of Denver for them to break even over their life from an energy point of view. It takes so much energy to produce the solar panels that you never break even over a 20-some-year life. So it's,
no, the only,
it's
the only way, the, and there's no, I mean, there's
Carolina
no,
or south.
We have a solar sponsor, and he'll tell you the same thing. The only thing that's making that work right now, Steve, are tax credits.
Oh, yeah. You get a lot of,
That's it. Without tax credits, you are 100% correct. They're not working.
Net metering and all that stuff.
That's right. You're 100% correct. Steve, where do folks buy the book? I know we've been on before, but let's mention it again.
Yeah, so it's on Amazon. There are ebooks on Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google. They can get a signed copy from me if they go to my website, Steve Goreham, GOREHAM.com.
Great. Steve, I appreciate you very much. As you know already, we speak the same language. Just keep doing the great work. I'll do the same on this end, and maybe someday we'll make some changes.
Okay, John, thanks.
You betcha, Steve. I appreciate it. Have a great night. And, yeah, I hope somebody like him, because I don't have time to do it, could sit down and really roll through the actual barrel cost when building an EV, including all of the infrastructure costs that go along with it. There's some studies out that'll tell you how much it takes rolling down the assembly line. That's not the number I'm looking for. I want the entire number, and then I want that number compared against an ICE engine vehicle, and then I want to take the mileage of each vehicle over its lifespan and add that into it, and then determine how many miles, or do you ever break even on the EV when it comes to the things that we're talking about. I've yet to see anybody do the math, and here's my gut feeling as to why, folks. Somebody like Steve may come up with it, but the other side is not going to give you that number. Why? Because mathematically, I don't think it works. I think they know. I think some have done it. But it's one of those things they're not going to report on or give you the data on because they know that it's not good for them. So you're never going to see that produced. Sort of like when we talked to, you know, Dr. Kelly and Steve House on Thursdays about the mRNA injections and all of that. There's so much information that I don't think they're releasing because they know if people knew it, they probably wouldn't buy it in the first place. This is John Rush from Rush to Reason and Drive Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Check out more of our podcasts at rushtoreason.com or drive-radio.com.